Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, environmental journalist Cynthia Barnett, loves rain. For her new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History, she traveled the globe to explore the rainiest places on Earth and explore how we have understood and misunderstood rain throughout history. Looking back, we have always had a conflicted relationship with rain. Rain inspired literary giants like Emily Dickinson and Mark Twain. Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Conrad Aiken called raindrops the syllables of water. Rain has also played a significant role in shaping and defining many cultures. Native Americans consider pouring rain male and soft rain female, both equally vital to life and landscape. But rain, or the lack of rain, has also contributed to the demise of civilizations, caused famine, social instability, fear, and paranoia. Cynthia Barnett argues that skeptics use the great climate swings of Earth's history to argue that the heat-trapping gases of modern life are not to blame for today's global warming and the rise of extreme rains, storms, and floods. In fact, our past climate swings give us all the more reason to confront this new threat. Cynthia Barnett is an award-winning environmental journalist who has reported on water from the Suwannee River of southern Georgia and northern Florida to Singapore. She is the author of two previous books, Mirage and Blue Revolution. Her most recent is Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. Cynthia teaches environmental journalism at the University of Florida. She'll be speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at Book Passage in Corte Madera, and she joins me now in studio. Hi, Cynthia. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I really enjoyed your book, and I have to say, when we got it, a lot of our colleagues said, Rain?
Really?
What is this book about? So talk a little bit about what inspired this book. I understand that your last two books about water were really sort of about policy.
Yeah, so I've, as you mentioned, I'm a longtime environmental journalist, and water has been my beat for many years. My first book was about, you know, the strange story of how water could be vanishing in the American East, one of the wettest places in the world. And my second book was called Blue Revolution, and it was a call for a water ethic in the same spirit that Aldo Leopold called for a land ethic 60 years ago. So, but I have to say, in those cases, I came to feel I was really always preaching to the choir. There would be the same sorts of audiences when I would give talks and so on. And I really wanted to challenge myself to try to write about water for a general audience. The other thing I found is that as I went around the country talking about water, I found that even people who didn't want to talk about climate change, they love to talk about the weather,
right,
and especially rain. So they would, you know, they might be unwilling to engage in the climate change discussion, but they want to talk about drought and extreme rains. They want to talk about hurricanes. And so really came to see weather and especially rain as a journalistic entree to climate change. But the other reality is that I just love rain.
Yeah.
I've always loved rain since childhood.
Well, and you make a good point, because last year when the drought started getting so much attention in California, I would often hear people talk about rain, especially when it wasn't raining. People would say,
absolutely,
when is it going to start raining again? We have to pray for rain.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's how I feel when there hasn't been rain, or when the sun feels just incredibly oppressive, as it does sometimes where I live in Florida in the middle of summer. I get kind of down when there hasn't been, you know, a beautiful rainstorm. And so I think weather does impact people in pretty profound ways. And I'm inspired by rain. Some people, like your colleagues, might say, what? A whole book of rain? But it's been a really neat way for me to engage on this topic of water in a new way.
Well, and I really enjoyed it because we do so many policy shows, which, of course, we love. And
right,
we'll talk about that with you.
Right.
But first, let's just talk about Rain. I mean, I love thinking about the way you look at it. You're looking at water that falls from the sky from every possible perspective.
Right.
Rain really gives the world its color.
Yeah, so I argue that rain has an unfair reputation for making the world dull and gray, right? When you think about rain, rain gives life, and then it blazes life with color. So even when you think about animals, right, desert animals are pale and sandy to reflect the sun's heat, and rainforest animals are just wildly bright to be able to find each other in the rain-blurred jungle. For this book, I traveled to the Cambridge Butterfly Museum in England to interview a scientist who works on a butterfly called the African bush, the squinting bush brown. And he found that those that emerge in dry times in Africa are smaller. They have smaller eye spots. They eat less food. The bigger ones are, you know, they're more beautiful, they're brighter, they have huge eye spots, they even get more sex. So, you know, rain has these amazing influences. Oh, I just have to say one more thing about the sky. So when it hasn't rained in a long time, all the dust really builds up in the atmosphere and it changes from blue to sort of milky white. And a good rainstorm is what washes all that away. It literally scrubs the sky back to the incredible, you know, blue celeste best that it can be. So I really think that rain brightens life.
Yeah, we finally got some last week.
You did.
We're hoping for more.
You did,
yes.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the drought that's hitting California. You brought up the butterfly, and we really enjoyed this section of your book, The Squinting Bush Brown. Mm-hmm. So the vibrancy and the patterns of this butterfly depend entirely on whether emerges in rainy or dry times.
That's exactly right. It's called elasticity, and all kinds of creatures do different things depending on, you know, whether they're from rainy places or dry places. And that's true. That's true with skin color and with how large different creatures can get. So weather and climate can really have an interesting impact on species, and including on us. You may have read the part about where our finger wrinkles come from, and even our finger wrinkles are related. They're an adaptation from so long ago when our ancestors lived in pluvial times before the East African landscape turned to savanna. That was a very wet, rainy place. And some neurological research has showed that our finger wrinkles are an adaptation, that we needed to have a way to hang on in wet times. And we humans have those wrinkles, but other primates also have those wrinkles.
You also write about the misconceptions we have about the shape of raindrops.
Oh, right. So That's really a metaphor for something bigger. I think we have a lot of misperceptions about our climate that we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. But yes, maybe the most basic one, we have a misperception about even what rain looks like. From the time we're little kids, we will draw a raindrop with a fat, rounded bottom and a pointy top. But in reality, raindrops fall the opposite of that. That image is upside down. They fall in the shape of tiny parachutes or tiny hamburger buns. And that, you know, that makes sense. It's from the air pressure that's pushing up from below. So I sort of start with that misperception, but I think we misperceive our climate in really profound ways, you know, that have us develop on sea cliffs and drain wetlands and so on. So that raindrop became a metaphor for something much bigger. Mm. And that was the idea.
What are some of the other misconceptions we have about rain? Because from the earliest times, humans have had this sort of love-hate relationship with rain. Humans have tried to stop the rain or bring more of it, but we've never been able to truly control it.
Right. So maybe the deepest misconception we have, and this goes for not just rain, but water in general and other parts of our environment, we sort of have this hubris to think that eventually we'll be able to get the better of this stuff, right? We in the early times, some of the first gods were rain gods. We thought we could pray to rain gods and change the climate. Later on, if we look at our own development in the United States, Jefferson thought that we would have small farms patchworked all over the West, that we could overcome the dry climate. Just looking at where we live in the United States and how we've populated arid states, we see that we've got lots of people dependent on a very little bit of rain here in the West. Where I live in Florida, we did the opposite. We drained a state that was half submerged, wanting to get rid of water and thinking that we could harness nature that way. And that's now coming back to haunt us. So, hopefully we can learn lessons from some of these stories in the past and think about how we can live differently, especially as the climate is changing.
I'm speaking with Cynthia Barnett about her new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. And Cynthia traveled the globe to explore the rainiest places on Earth. She also explores how we have understood and misunderstood rain throughout history. What is your relationship with rain? Some love it. We love to walk in it, but then others don't really like it. In fact, we'll talk about Emily Dickinson later in the show and her relationship with rain. I was thinking about some people living in like Seattle where they feel like it's gray a lot. They stay in a lot. In some dark places, it can cause depression.
It can.
Right?
And I wouldn't want to discount that. Seasonal affective disorder is a very serious disorder for the people who suffer from it and people who have studied Emily Dickinson but believe that she suffered from SAD. And so people in Seattle may get a little bit down about the rain, but I've met lots of people in Seattle who are also very proud to be from there and very, sort of in love with their rain. So it really depends on the person. People have a lot of different reactions to rain, and they're very, very personal. It often depends on where you grew up. If you grew up in Seattle, you might really miss those beautiful, silvery, drizzly skies when you go to a dry place. And if you grew up in Phoenix, you might really feel oppressed by gray skies when you go visit Seattle. I think a lot of this has to do with childhood and the memory of rain, and that goes for the scent of rain too, which we can talk about.
Well, if you would like to share your memories of rain, what rain means to you, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have any questions about rain, Cynthia Barnett wrote an entire book about rain, A Natural and Cultural History, and you can join us at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Emily Dickinson is interesting because she didn't like rain or bad weather. And yet the mood that resulted inspired some of her best work, because she wrote a lot of gloomy letters describing rain. And then people who have analyzed her poetry and her letters by season show that when she felt unhappy during bad weather seasons, she produced some of her best work.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Although I think Emily Dickinson could probably write beautifully about anything, even the common housefly, right? So, Emily Dickinson. There was analysis of her poetry. People had looked at her poetry by season and found that she wrote more poetry in summer and in summer times. But the more interesting part of the analysis was when a group of researchers looked at her poetry not by the quantity but by the quality, and I think they determined that by the number of poems that had won awards or been collected in anthologies and so on. And they found that she wrote her best poetry in I think it was the Wintry Times. Is that right? I'm trying to find
it in the book. It was in the sort of the gray
yes,
water,
right.
The gray seasons with lots of rain where
right.
she felt a lot of gloom.
Right, yeah. right. So even though she might not have felt inspired by it in the way she did A Beautifully Summery Day, it seemed to have a very deep impact on her. And there were some, you know, anecdotally, there are some interesting things about, like, Iceland has the highest number of published authors per capita.
Hmm.
Seattle has a very high number of published authors per capita. And it could be that there's just not so much opportunity to be outside and they have to go inside and hunker down. And that's one of the reasons. But it really is interesting to think about how rain can inspire creativity.
You also have really interesting information about Native Americans and then witchcraft. So Native Americans consider pouring rain male and soft rain female both equally vital to life and landscape.
Yes. Isn't that interesting? And it's true when you think about nature and what we need. We, you know, like here in California, you need a certain amount of snow
right.
To create the snowpack that then feeds the streams in the springtime. We need hard rains and we need soft rains. We need all of it. And so that's one interesting thing about climate change and the changes in rainfall patterns that scientists are seeing, because they are seeing more extreme rains and more of those hard downfalls. Rose, I found the Emily Dickinson poem I was searching for. So I just want to read you this little bit of this. This is from The Storm, incredible poem that gives you a great sense of her foreboding. There came a wind like a bugle. It quivered through the grass, and a green chill upon the heat so ominous did pass. We barred the windows and the doors as from an emerald ghost, the doom's electric moccasin that very instant passed. I love that. Doom's electric moccasin. It is just absolutely chilling, isn't it?
Reading a poem from Emily Dickinson, who didn't really like the rain, but as we were saying, some of her best work was produced during rainy seasons. I'm speaking today with environmental journalist Cynthia Barnett about her new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. And let's take a few calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Brian in San Francisco. Hi, Brian. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for the show and taking my call. It's a fascinating topic that I didn't even know was interesting until I started listening to the show, and I learned for the first time my perception of raindrops was upside down. So I'm a big fan of science and also scalable content, so I'm learning about your book by listening to the radio. I'm wondering if you have any plans to work with PBS type of scientific television shows like Nova or Nature to get the topic and the science of rain onto television to wider audiences.
Brian, thank you for calling, and I'm glad to hear that you learned something about raindrops. There is a filmmaker who is interested in taking this book and turning it into a film, but anyone who has dealt with that situation, as I have with my previous books, know that it's, you know, it's sort of unusual that happens. So I'm very hopeful, but I just don't know yet. But I think there are such, you know, vivid and visual stories and some, you know, crazy stories like the one Rose just mentioned about the extreme rains of the Little Ice Age and how women were actually hanged for conjuring storms in that time. So, you know, when I think about the book and the stories in the book, I think it would lend itself to television or film, but I'm sure every book author feels that way about her work. So we'll see what happens.
And this happened between 1560 and 1660.
Right. So the Little Ice Age was a longer period of extreme weather, really frightening weather for people at the time. It lasted from about 1350 to 1850, and it was a period of time, you know, really severe winters, worse than any winters in memory. Extreme storms, just really awful weather conditions that led to crop losses, famines, plagues. You know, these were just desperate times. And you know, people in their hunger became more and more paranoid and began to believe that witches were conjuring storms. So there's an interesting historian in Germany. You know, of course, we know the other reasons for witchcraft. It had to do with the religious situation, the socio-political situation at the time. But he has also tracked the crime of witchcraft as rising with some of the worst extremes in the Little Ice Age, which, as you mentioned, were between 1560 and 1660. And so thousands of people, mostly women, many times widows, poor women who were already dealing with all the ills of the age, thousands of them were convicted and then hanged for conjuring storms, conjuring hail. I mean, what incredible times.
Wow. And yeah. It lasted for a long
time. It lasted for a long time, this activity. And it really, you know, people also think of this as being fomented by the poor and the desperate. But it also came straight from the top. The story I write about in Rain involves King James. When he was king of Scotland, he was King James VI. And he was going to marry Princess Anna of Denmark. And when her ships were coming over to Scotland for the wedding, they hit these incredible storms, and people started believing that witches were causing these storms to try to keep her from becoming queen. And this just became, you know, it became a hysteria, really. And King James got caught up in it. King James came to believe that witches were trying to kill him by storm, were trying to keep him from his queen, and he got personally involved in the persecutions and the prosecutions and the interrogations of these people, and several people were executed, burned at the stake for those storms. And he went on to be very, you know, he was really convinced that witchcraft was a problem in Scotland. And then later, when he became King of England, he upped witch persecutions and prosecutions there too. And this stuff really didn't die off until the Enlightenment.
Well, I was going to ask you, how did it finally end?
Yeah, so it finally ended with, you know, the idea of evidence in both the courts and in science. Many people had always been concerned about it, but they really, you know, their voices were quashed by those who felt certain that witches were causing the ills of the time. So it was really the Enlightenment, the emergence of evidence in the courts, and of course the science that helped people begin to understand the atmosphere.
I'm speaking today with environmental journalist Cynthia Barnett about her new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. She explores how we have understood and misunderstood rain throughout history. After the break, we will talk about how climate change has altered the rainfall patterns, and then also about using rain as a weapon of war. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's conversation, call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org. Coming up in a half hour here on KLW, it's BBC World Have Your Say at 11 o'clock.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with Yoann Griot about his new book, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. He argues that since the Cold War ended, drug gangs have grown into violent cartels with enough power to strong-arm governments. So how are narcos affecting civil society across the Americas and the Caribbean? And then on Friday, it's our media roundtable, and we'll be discussing media coverage of what is happening in Flint, Michigan, and the lead-poisoned drinking water there. It's not just Flint, Michigan. The Guardian has a new piece out about what's happening across the entire East Coast, and we'll be talking about that as well on Friday. We'll talk with Cynthia about this later in the show. Today, we're joined by Cynthia Barnett. She is author of the new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. Cynthia is speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at Book Passage in Corte Madera. And you can find more information about her work and her talk at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to talk about your relationship with Rain, if you have any questions about Rain, we'd love to hear from you. We have an email from Ted in Juneau, Alaska, who says, "Good morning from Alaska. As a longtime former San Francisco resident, I have lived through my share of dry winters and water-saving devices and methods. Now, having lived in Juneau, Alaska for a dozen years, I must say, what a pleasure it is to live in an environment where we never have to think about watering plants and drinking water. It has been raining here for the past week. A few inches have fallen, as always, and we still get our share of beautiful sunny days. Every time I think of returning to California to live, water issues are my number one reason to stay put in beautiful Juneau. I joke that you can turn on the tap here and return 2 days later to shut it off without feeling guilty about wasting water. Also, electric energy is another beneficial aspect of living here. No fossil fuels for our electricity."
Well, there are always fossil fuels for electricity, always some fossil fuels. So the interesting thing about, could you live in a wet place and just let the water run and run and run and not feel guilty? The thing to remember is that you are using a lot of energy to run that water, right? So that's where the fossil fuels may come in that he's not thinking about. But I want to go back to his larger point, Ted. I think it's a beautiful point you made that you really, because you lived in a dry place, you have come to value water and appreciate water. You have this great ethic for water. And that is, I think, nationally what we really lack. And that doesn't, you know, whether you live in California or the relatively wet East where I live, you know, we really, some people have it, don't get me wrong, and many people here have it because they know what it's like to live in a drought. But for the most part, I think we don't feel that value for water, and that is a big part of the water stress that we have, both when it comes to water quantity and water quality. So it was really beautiful to listen to how lyrically and reverentially you described the rainfall and the water in Alaska.
Well, thank you for calling in, Ted, and lucky you, Alaska's such a beautiful place. To your point, Cynthia, do you feel like our relationship with water and the way we use water changes when we're in the middle of a drought? Or, for example, as we're reading about this horrible situation in Flint, Michigan, do you think it changes?
Yeah, so people do become more conscientious during a drought. But what needs to happen, and what I think is slowly happening, is that we value water or have this ethic for water, you know, all the time, just as we value our family, our health, the things most important to us. The situation in Flint, Michigan, and, you know, it's not just Flint.
Right.
This huge chemical spill in Charleston, West Virginia, shut down the water supply there. Harmful algal blooms in Lake Erie shut down the water supply in Toledo, Ohio. You know, these are huge emergencies. When you think about losing your water supply, the hospital can't do surgery. You know, there's all kinds of things that just come to a halt. And we really take water for granted, and we don't think about how valuable it is. And I think that's true whether we're dealing with dry places or whether we're dealing with water quality.
We're going to talk about this story in The Guardian on Friday, but they got their hands on documents from an anonymous source with extensive knowledge of lead and copper regulations. And according to these documents, the approach to water testing is so widespread that it occurs in every major U.S. city east of Mississippi. By word of mouth, this has become the thing to do in the water industry. The logical conclusion is that millions of people's drinking water is potentially unsafe. Mm-hmm. According to this source, documents seen by The Guardian show that water boards in cities like Detroit and Philadelphia, the state of Rhode Island, have distorted tests by using methods deemed misleading by the EPA.
It sounds like some of those pediatricians in those places will be getting to work testing children for lead poisoning. And the thing about that is that most of us think of lead poisoning as something that just doesn't happen in the United States and couldn't happen here. You know, we have this feeling that we have very, very clean tap water. And some of these situations are showing that that's not true. And you know, climate change is really also going to change our water quality fortunes when it comes to harmful algae blooms. These are algae that have survived on Earth for 4 billion years, but in conditions where water is warmer, or it or it has too many nutrients, they can change and become harmful. And this is the emergency that shut down Toledo's drinking water, something you're seeing more of in California, really all over the country. And that, I think, is another emerging pollution issue that is really going to take people by surprise.
Environmental journalist Cynthia Barnett is out with a new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. She's speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at Book Passage in Corte Madera. And let's go back to phone calls. Let's hear from G.S. in San Leandro. Hi, G.S. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Hello, Cynthia. Obviously, your book has just hopped to the top of my reading list.
Thank you.
I had three truly awe-inspiring experiences with rain. Actually, a question with the first one. Fog is really just a cloud, but does that count as rain, all the little particles of rain?
That's a really good question. I mean, we do delineate. We have all of these different words, but it's all water. It's actually all water, right? It's all part of this beautiful cycle that whether we can see it or whether we can't, or whether it's snow or rain or fog or in a river or in your tap or even in the toilet, it's all, you know, this amazing miracle substance.
Sure. Okay, well, the first one with for awe in my life, once when I was a boy, my brothers and I were out, surprised to see that it was sort of darkish outside. We went outside and we could not see the hands at the end of our arms. And it was the most incredible thing. You couldn't see. You weren't sure suddenly where you were. And it was an amazing experience. It was very awe-inspiring. Second one was, and I've always loved this one, if you're any place where you can hear the rain hitting the roof, or if you happen to be in a tent, it's even more amazing, when it's pouring really hard. You realize the power of water. It weighs about 7 pounds per gallon, and if there are lots of raindrops falling, that's a massive amount of weight, and it's all loud when it hits stuff. So anyway, and finally, and this is one of the most awe-inspiring experiences I've ever had, I was in a private aircraft flying with some friends from California into Nevada, and there was a thunderstorm up ahead of us, and the sun was behind us. I got to see the one and only full circle rainbow I've ever seen.
Oh, how beautiful. Beautiful. How incredible.
And it was, you know, it wasn't up close, so it would be like, you know, 10 or 15 feet you might see with a spray of water from a hose. You know, kids do that. This thing was like miles across.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it was, I wanted to cry. It was so beautiful. I just thought I'd tell you about that one.
I love that. Thank you so much for calling, GS, and those are just remarkable memories, and I love, too, what you said about the sound of rain. And to me, it sounds like applause, and it makes me want to applaud. You know, whether you hear it on a roof or when you hear it on palm fronds, it just seems to me that the earth is applauding that rain.
Hmm. GS raises a question about what rain does to us. If we enjoy rain, and say we're in warm water and it's raining, that's another amazing experience.
That feels great. I love swimming in the rain.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. Do we know what it does to our overall mental well-being? Because we did a show recently about nature and how spending time in nature reduces your stress levels. It actually improves your breathing functions. Do we know anything about rain?
You know, that's a really good question. When the book came out, I was contacted by a medical researcher in Southern California who was looking at the impact of drought on people's recovery. And I'm a recovery from illness. And I haven't followed up with him to find out if his paper came out, but I'll do that. And if I can find it, I'll send it to you and we'll put it on the website, because it seems, you know, we know all of the research about nature deficit disorder and how our disconnection from nature has really hurt us in so many ways, leading from everything to obesity, attention deficit disorder, many other problems in childhood and adulthood. So it stands to reason that we also would be impacted in some physical and emotional way by the lack of rain over a long time.
Well, thank you so much for calling, GS. We love that story. Let's go next to Margaret in San Francisco. Hi, Margaret. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Cynthia and Rose. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Cynthia, you have a name that means the moon.
Yes.
Cynthia.
Yes.
And Rose.
That's right.
Rose Willow is the name of my daughter.
Ah.
In 1976, she was born at home with midwives.
Was it raining?
Santa Cruz at the double rainbow over the house.
Ah.
The Hopi Indian women came in my dream and gave me a blessing. And then it was a freak snowstorm, a breasting bray. That's a Scottish term.
Ah.
With the hail.
Yes.
And, oh, my Lord, I'm crying tears of joy right now.
Oh, my gosh, I love it.
I live at 666 Ellis Garden Apartments in San Francisco. We've been watering our plants during the drought, tenderly and with such care, and now the beautiful drenching that we have, our rosemary, our lavender, our coral nymph that we planted from seed, bird of paradise. We have exquisite hothouse flowers here that are safe. There was a crisis was averted. I don't want to go into it now, but I want to recall the Robert Graves poem, Turn of the Moon. Are you familiar with it? Never forget who brings the rain in swarthy goatskin bags from a far sea. It is the moon as she turns, and who can rule her?
And there I was, the moon bringing the rain. Margaret, that is so absolutely beautiful. And what was the Scottish term you used for the storm?
The breasting brae.
Right, right. So I have a section about rain and language, and I'll just read you quickly a few words for rain. In Scotland, people might say a heavy rain is chucking it doon, teeming skelp it, stoating off, bouncing off the streets. A soft one that hangs in the air is a smur or a har. Light rains have a graceful language with their mizzles and drizzles. And, of course, in Ireland, a persistent drizzle is known as a soft day, which I think is so beautiful.
Wow. Thank you so much for calling in, Margaret, and sharing all of those stories. Thank you so much. I'm speaking today with environmental journalist Cynthia Barnett about her new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. Cynthia is speaking tonight at 7 at Book Passage in Corte Madera. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Her book, Rain, takes a look at how we have understood and misunderstood rain throughout history. And let's go next to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose and Cynthia. You know, just, it is Cynthia, right?
Yes, hi.
You know, with you talking about rain and water, I mean, I could very easily identify 04 or 5 or 6 rain situations, and I remembered who I was with and where it was and,
yes,
and when it was, going back at least as far as the early 70s, and the most recent one, 2000, well, it wasn't rain, but it was water, and meeting a guy whose job it was to check on the reservoirs throughout Portland, and that's critical to it because Portland had open reservoirs, and of course, after 9/11, they said, "Oh, you know, stuff can get put in it." And of course, it's monitored 24 hours a day by their chemical analysis. And there was a cute little duck that was taking the intake flue or whatever it is, and then coming out the chute when the water was being sprayed out. It was like an amusement park for the little duck. But I remembered also when New York State had Love Canal. You know, I was at Queens College, and it was really obvious to me that the United States was going to have the same problems that the Third World has with issues of potable water, because we had poisoned so much of ours, whereas in a lot of the Third World, you have infectious disease problems as well as other things. But you know, I mean, rain is just part of the water cycle, and what comes to mind is balance. That there's, you know, just like human beings can't live, you know, if their body temperature goes much above.
And Bill, I hate to cut you off, but do you have a specific question for Cynthia? Because we have a bunch of people on the line.
Yeah. You know, how do we get people to understand that we have people who could probably go back to Let's Burn the Witches? How do we get people to understand the marvelous wonder and complexity of rain?
So that's my job, Bill. That's what I try to do. I love the question, and I love your statement about how you have such vivid memories of where you were and who you were with when it was raining. And it makes me think of rain as a punctuation to whatever we're doing. The weather kind of punctuates experience in that way. But I think to answer your question, I would say I think the last time Americans were truly engaged in water as a nation was the early 70s, when you had, you know, there were terrible epic drought here in the West, and there were, you know, it was the age of dams. There were proposals even to dam the Grand Canyon. People were very upset about those issues in the West. And in the East, people were fed up with visible pollution in the rivers and in the bays and in the lakes. You know, you had society matrons in pearls protesting next to long-haired environmentalists over river pollution in the East, industrial pollution in the East. I really think we are getting to such a time now when the combination of scarcity in the West and issues of water quality in the East, you know, Flint, Toledo, Charleston, West Virginia, we heard in The Guardian there may be more of this coming. It does not have to be that way, and people know it, and I think we're really going to see people in this country becoming aware and saying this is not okay in the same way they did in the 70s. And when you think about that time, you know, we did bring an end pretty much to the age of dams. We did create the Clean Water Act, the EPA, and other environmental protections. I think we're heading into another time of, widespread caring and wanting to live differently with water.
Well, thank you for calling in. Today I'm speaking with Cynthia Barnett about her new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. And she's speaking tonight at Book Passage at 7 o'clock in Corte Madera. And we have an email from Jack who says, this is a great topic and vindicates me. My wife and I have an ongoing dispute about rainy days. I love the way rain changes the exterior world, much like snow or fog. Too many rainy days in a row can be difficult, but rain forces us to slow down, reflect, and mitigates the urgency to hurry up, get out, and do something all the time.
Oh, I'm with you, Jack. I am so with you. That's a wonderful comment. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jack. Let's hear next from Shirley in Mountain View. Hi, Shirley.
Yes, hi.
Hi, Shirley.
I was hoping that this program would be an educational one. Given this, the scientific illiteracy of most people in America these days, many people do not know that the Earth is a closed system and that water is constantly recycled. And when they do know that, it makes a huge difference. So I would hope that you would now devote the rest of the program to the science and less to the poetry. Thank you.
Too much poetry and not enough science. Let me say something about that idyllic water cycle you describe. I think it's almost problematic that we teach kids in science class that there's this perfect hydrological cycle, right? Water never disappears. It evaporates back up into the atmosphere. It comes back down. It trickles back into the atmosphere. It's all perfect. Well, actually, when you introduce humans into that hydrological cycle, it becomes a hydroillogical cycle. Anyone who's lived with a disappeared spring, as happens where I live, or a vanished lake, knows that water can disappear. We know that once humans are part of the cycle, we can change the cycle in really dramatic ways. And so I think maybe we have to talk about, I agree that we need to talk about the science and need to talk about the water cycle and you know, maybe to explain it a little more directly from the time we first learn about water.
Hmm. Well, and also, it's been difficult for meteorologists to predict rain because of fluctuations in weather patterns.
Yeah,
now.
Sure.
And then you also write that while rain is one of the trickier parts of the atmosphere to measure and understand, changing rainfall patterns are among the earliest and most obvious tremors of a warming planet.
Right.
So as you said, we are seeing so many more heavy downpours now.
Yes, that's right. And this makes perfect sense when you think about it, and as the caller just requested to talk more about the science. So we know greenhouse gases push temperatures higher. Higher temperatures cause greater evaporation and therefore greater rainfall where water exists, and they make it hotter and drier where there's not a lot of water. So it makes absolute sense that with a warming globe, we're going to see more extreme rains in places where it's already wet and more extreme drought in places where it's already droughty. And those can be some devastating impacts.
In the northeastern U.S., there has been a 74% increase in heavy precipitation events just over the past 50 years.
That's right. It's really incredible to look at the numbers and to see how extreme rains are increasing in America's northeast and in certain hot spots all around the world.
So what can we learn from the changes that we're seeing? And what would you like to see in terms of how to deal with climate change? You're from Florida, and a number of mayors in Florida just wrote a letter to Marco Rubio saying, hey, can you please just acknowledge climate change, because we're drowning in some of these cities.
Right. The strangest thing is that our leaders don't acknowledge the science. So I live in a state where the governor does not acknowledge the science of climate change, and we are in the state most vulnerable to sea level rise and, of course, most vulnerable to an increase in extreme hurricanes. You can say the same about the governor of Texas and the governor of Louisiana. You've got climate change deniers who are sitting governors in states in the Great Plains that are most vulnerable to droughts. And, you know, I think the first issue, and I think this is happening, I think that the first thing that we need to do is elect leaders who understand the science and acknowledge the science and help us start living differently with water, developing differently, start to take action. This is not happening at all in many parts of the Southeast. Now, the mayors you mentioned have been quite proactive in South Florida because they can see the incredible flooding in the streets that's happening even on sunny days as a result of sea level rise.
And last question, about 30 seconds. One of your last books was about water ethics.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
After doing research for rain, what's now at the top of your list when it comes to creating a water ethic?
The second book, Blue Revolution, is a call for a water ethic for the United States. And as I mentioned, that is that we would come to value water in every sector of the economy. So we always tend to want quick fixes, right? We want to build the next pipeline or the next reservoir or do the next huge thing or the next desalination plant. Really, the most important thing we can do is live with less and pollute less.
Environmental journalist Cynthia Barnett's latest book is Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. Cynthia is speaking tonight at 7 p.m. at Book Passage in Corte Madera. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. Cynthia, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the callers for the great rain memories.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with journalist Yoann Griot about his new book, Gangster Warlords, Drug Dollars, Killing Fields, and the New Politics of Latin America. In 2014, U.S. authorities detained more than 67,000 unaccompanied children fleeing violence in Central America. Since the Cold War ended, Griot says drug gangs have turned into violent cartels with enough power to strong-arm governments. So how are narcos affecting civil society across the Americas and the Caribbean? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.